G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Sweet from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a great guest lined up for you today. It is a young woman who is doing great things in boxing, and that is Lakeisha Pergoletti. And my apologies there for slipping over her name. But anyway, John, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
It's good to be back, and we've missed, believe it or not, our 20th birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was at the end of September and I was away.
Picking up more frequent flyers, were you?
I was indeed. Yeah. But, yeah, so we'll try and maybe have maybe the next show where we have a big celebration of the 20 years of Not the Footy Show.
Wow, is it really 20 years?
20 years, yep.
Wow. That's,
I didn't think it would last this long. No. I mean, what was it, 9.5 years on the radio and then we've been doing the podcast for the last 11.
Wow, that's quite a commitment.
It has been, and we're very close to, is it 700th show or something?
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that's, we should get an award, really, shouldn't we?
Oh, it would be nice, but yeah. Who would nominate us?
There you go, listeners. There's some homework for you. Find an award to nominate us for.
Yeah, well, we can just nominate.
So you have been, well, you've been up in Malaysia?
Yep.
You've been in Croatia?
No, I was in the Czech Republic.
Czech.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had the premiere of the new documentary about Vera Chislavska.
Who is?
For those a Czech gymnast that in 1968 protested against the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. And so the film is about her career leading up to that point and then what happened to her after that.
I won't spoil it by asking, but it seemed to go down very, very well.
It blew me away the reception that it had in the Czech Republic. I mean, obviously, she is a national hero for them, like almost sort of like Bradman-esque in terms of how she is revered over there. So it was a bit nervous because you sort of think, I hope they like the film.
Cultural icon.
Yeah. And I mean, her daughter came to the premiere of it as well, and she hadn't seen the film. So that was, again, nerve-wracking for me. But the great thing was she loved the film and said she actually learned stuff about her mum that she didn't know. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, so that was really, really good.
Excellent. Oh, are you going to start today?
Okay, I can start. Yep.
Yeah, lead off.
Now, I think we all know that getting sponsorship in any sport these days is pretty tricky because, as we've said before, a lot of the sponsors aren't actually getting anything in return and they are just donors in that they're putting money into the sport, not expecting anything back. Now, we know that there are the first tier sports, and then there's the second tier sports. And we've always discussed that hockey is a second tier sport because it's not got professional players, etc.
Slipping.
Well, in case
anyway, keep
yeah.
Going.
But what I'm going to say is one thing I don't think is ever going to help the game to attract sponsors as a whole is when you have with Hockey One, as we've seen in the last month or so, umpires and players going on social media asking for people to support them so that they can play in what we are told is the premier competition in Australia for our male and female hockey players, which is Hockey One. That has got to be detrimental to the sport. And certainly I know people that have seen it and said, whoa, what's going on with hockey? You know, if players are out there asking for their own financial support for them to be able to play in this competition. And the fact that umpires have got that, and I mean, I know that the umpires were sent a letter reminding them that they were volunteers and were not going to be paid by Hockey One. Now, you could say, okay, this is a problem we've got here in Australia, but then if you look at New Zealand at the Sultan of Johor Cup that I was at, those players playing for their national under-21 team had to fund themselves to play in that tournament. Now, the average cost was about $5,000 to $6,000 New Zealand for that. Then these players are looking to go to the Junior World Cup, and their mums and dads again and friends are having to fund them to go to the Junior World Cup. And I believe that's costing around $12,000 for them to fly there and all the accommodation, all the bits and pieces that go with it. So this is not good for the sport. And somebody, or they need to sit down, because the impression that's giving to potential sponsors is that the game is not in a good state.
Well, you wouldn't think so, on based on just that evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, John, I'm always outspoken about stuff like this. And, I mean, I think, you know, we were sold a pup that this was going to be a franchise league, Hockey One. It's being run by the state bodies. Now, if the state bodies can't afford to bring in the money to pay the players, then should they be competing in this competition? That's my argument. And I don't think that they can afford to play in it, so therefore they shouldn't be playing in it, because they're also trying to pass on supplementary fees onto the likes of you to help support or make the losses less for their participation in this competition, which is for a small group of players.
Yeah. Well, we got stung early on with the old Pro League levy, didn't we? When a few years ago. And the Pro League, how pro is it today? It ain't, is it?
No, and I mean,
those players aren't getting paid to perform in the Pro League.
No, and we were told that they would. We were told they would in Hockey One. I think it was 3 years we were told the players would be professional. But the other thing is, you know, with the Pro League, now you've got teams using it as a development league. So how's that ever going to attract sponsorship when you're trying to promote saying that the best teams in the world are playing with their best players and they're not, because countries are going, well, no, we know what the good guys can do. We'll let them still play for their clubs and we'll just bring other players in and develop them. So the whole league itself has lost its way and is no longer what it was set out to be.
Yeah, I still have a lot of problems with some of the conditions of play. In, you know, like the double goal thing is just...
Hate it. Absolutely hate it.
You know, shootouts, not... Do they move anybody? Are they any more exciting? I don't know. Look, when you get to the end of, say, a grand final, you've got to have a mechanism for if it's nil all after 10 hours.
When it's a knockout game, I have no problem. When it's a league, why do you need a result?
Well... It would be the only league in the world that gives teams that couldn't win a bonus point. Wouldn't it be?
I can't think of another.
I mean, usually in sport, a bonus point is available to both sides, regardless of the result. You know, like rugby had, if you scored over X amount of points.
Yeah, five tries, or if you lose by less than a certain amount of points.
So... why can't a team that's just won the game have the ability to score a bonus point as well?
Yeah.
If you're going to have this shootout stuff happening, it's got to be a...
Well, as someone said to me, they said, how about doing it that for every goal that you score, you get a bonus point for those goals? So if you made it, say, over four, you know, you score four goals, the fifth goal gets you a bonus point. If you get a sixth, you get two bonus points, because it's going to encourage teams to go forward.
Or even if you want this bonus point thing, at the end of every game, you have a shootout.
Yeah.
So you could lose 5-0 and still get something out of the game.
I don't like the shootout unless it's a knockout game. I think it's just not necessary.
No.
But, and I would still prefer extra time, sudden death for a start, because for the reasons, as I wrote in one of the blog pieces on notthefootyshow.com, was that if you look at the percentage of times the team that scores the equaliser will win the shootout, I think in the men's game it was something like 78 to 82% of the time they will win it. In the women's it was a little bit lower. So you do get an advantage, because obviously the momentum shifted to you.
Yeah, well... There's many more problems with Hockey One than just tinkering with a few rules.
Yeah, but I just think clearly the money is not there to support the competition, so therefore you've got to rethink it.
What does the CEO do for 10.5 months of the year?
Yeah, I've been wondering that for a while.
Remember,
they kept the position filled as well throughout COVID. Wasn't even put on less time.
I mean, I've often said to you and other people, the only people that get paid in hockey are administrators and umpires. And in this case, the umpires aren't even getting paid, but the administrators are.
Yep.
So if the umpires are volunteers, why shouldn't the administrators be volunteers? I'm pretty sure we could have a game of hockey without administrators. But it's very difficult to have one without umpires. You can do it, but it's pretty difficult.
But also, again, we have a board for Hockey One of which some of the members are now people whose term has finished on Hockey Australia. But when you look at the clubs are all owned by the state bodies, why do we need a board? Surely a representative from those state bodies should be on the board.
Well,
because they're at the conference. Owned,
when you say owned, can I buy a franchise?
Well, I'm not sure.
Well,
but
know a former Australian player who tried to buy a franchise.
And I don't know what the story is with the new team that is coming in Melbourne. Are they, because they got government funding and, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if they're a privately owned group of people.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if Hockey One's going to be successful, that is the future.
Yeah.
State bodies having nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
They should be worrying about running competitions in their own states.
Well, that's what they're there to do, just to administer the sport for everybody, from the sort of semi-professional guys at the top to the amateurs and the kids at the bottom.
Be nice to have fixtures before the season starts.
I never understand why you guys don't have that.
Well, we used to.
Yeah, I mean, the season's finished, so you should have them before Christmas, I would have thought.
Hello, my name is Joe Cortez, international boxing referee from Las Vegas, Nevada, the boxing capital of the world. Listen to Not the Footy Show. It's a knockout. Check it out.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're very pleased to have as a special guest on this show, Lakeisha Pergoliti. She was one of three women that went to the Boxing World Championships in the UK and came back with a medal. Emma Sue Greentree won the bronze, Tash Flint won a gold, and Lakeisha won a silver. So it's with great pleasure we welcome her to Not the Footy Show. Lakeisha Pergoliti, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm looking forward to catching up with you, and congratulations on your silver medal at the World Championships. That was a fantastic achievement.
Yeah, thank you. It's still a bit of a surreal thing, still kind of pinching myself, but yeah, super pleased with my achievement.
What was great, though, was for women's boxing, three medals at those World Championships, and I mean, that I think has really elevated the sport and women's boxing in Australia, because people are suddenly going, whoa. Mm.
Oh, 100%. We just made history. Like Tash Flint, our 80-kilo girl, she's the first female or male to ever bring home a gold medal from World Championships. So that was huge. And then obviously myself getting gold, and then our 75-kilo Emma Greentree also getting bronze. And she's a two-time bronze world medalist. So, yeah.
I hate to say it, you just said you won gold, but you won a silver.
I did win silver. Not gold. I was wishing for the gold. Hopefully next time.
No, you did indeed. Well, I suppose I want to go back now. And how did you get involved in boxing? Because I believe it took a while. You were doing other sports like playing football, the world game.
Yes.
And also basketball.
Yeah. So growing up, I played all different sports and then definitely took a liking towards soccer and kind of focused on that. And then I broke my ankle and had to have surgery, and I was always around the sport of boxing. Like, my dad had a tin shed gym in our backyard from like before I was born, but I didn't really show much interest growing up. Like, it wasn't my thing. And then once I got injured, my dad kind of suggested, like, why don't you come in, you know, do a bit of strength, get strong, like, you can't run, all this. So I was like, okay, I'll come in. And yeah, I just fell in love with the sport, and I ended up trading the soccer boots for boxing gloves, and yeah, I didn't look back after that.
So was he a boxer himself?
He did train. He never got medically cleared, and he had a few health problems, I guess, around the time that he wanted to fight. And then, yeah, I guess he kind of made the switch to becoming a coach and opening his own gym, and yeah, it's still going to this day, and still in our still in my parents' backyard back in Australind.
And I mean, how was it early on in that? Did he try and I mean, I'm sure he coached you the rudimentary things, but what's it like having your dad as your coach?
It was interesting. It was good, though. Like, I would never trade it for anything else. I think obviously it had its challenges. I think we tried to keep a good balance. You know, what happens in the gym stays in the gym, what happens at home stays at home. But naturally these things also kind of would conflict. But yeah, at the time I look back, and I'm very grateful for those years. It also it allowed me to have a really good relationship with my dad as well. Spent a lot of time together. And I'm still really close with my dad. Like, now he's not coach, he's just dad, which I really enjoy. But yeah, I wouldn't trade those years for anything.
You talk boxing with him now still?
No. So, well, like, we do, and he's still, like, you know, I'll still send him, like, bits and pieces and just to get his opinion. But yeah, now he's just dad, which I really enjoy because, yeah, obviously throughout those years being heavily involved in my sport, being my coach. But, yeah, I still have a lot of respect for him as a coach as well. Like, I think he's still very knowledgeable and all of that. So, yeah.
So when you started out in your sort of boxing career, he was your coach then, I take it, before you got into the elite program.
Yes.
Do you remember your first fight?
Yeah, I do. I think it was towards the end of 14. And I remember I fought a girl from Victoria. So they actually flew this girl over. She had 7 fights at the time. It was my first fight. I remember my mum was like in absolute shambles. She's like, she's going off at my dad. She's like, you said our girls would, because I have a younger sister. And she was like, you said our girls will never box. Like, you know, she's freaking out. My dad's like, it's fine. She's prepared. She's 15, like, you know, 14, 15 years old. Like, it's not, it's, like, a lot of people, I guess, have a misconception that it's, like, a very brutal sport, a very barbaric thing. But especially, like, in those young years when you're a novice, you've got headgear on, you've got big gloves on, the referee's in there to protect you. But, yeah, I remember beating this girl, and, yeah, it was definitely what, I guess, got me hooked. I loved that winning feeling.
Yeah, they say that you know very early on whether someone's going to be able to mix it in a boxing ring because that first punch in a real fight, how they react then? I mean, did you worry about that at all, or did you just think, I'm going to be okay?
I definitely think, so when you first start, it's a natural thing to either pull away from the punch or, you know, be scared or whatever. It's not a normal or natural thing to get punched in the face. Like, let's be honest, it's not. Yeah, it's so, a lot of people, it's a lot of, like, fight or flight. So some people, either they don't like getting hit, or it's the opposite, they actually don't like hitting other people. So I definitely think it takes a certain type of person to be in the ring and to compete in the sport.
And then when do you think you realised that you actually had a talent for it? Because clearly you do, and now you're part of the elite program. I mean, but what age was it where suddenly people started to go, you know what, Lakeisha, you've got something?
Probably around the age of like 16, 17. So as a junior and youth, I won like state titles, national titles. And I remember, at 16, I went to my first like elite competition. I couldn't get a lot of fights. Like at the time, it wasn't a very popular thing. I went to an elite competition as a 16-year-old, and I signed a bunch of papers to be there. I went into this tournament, and I had beaten the current Australian, elite Australian champion, which was huge. And then I also had fought a girl from New Zealand who I drew with and then won. And then I lost to a girl from Queensland, but that was my first elite competition as a 16-year-old, which was a little bit unheard of. And I think it got a lot of people's attention. And then from then on, yeah, I got into the Futures program and all these other programs and just kind of kept fighting and kept winning within Australia, and I think that's what kind of got people's attention.
The thing I find interesting is women's sport has evolved a lot in the last 20 years, but I mean, the good thing is now young girls boxing have yourselves as role models, and there are role models. Did you have anybody that you looked up as a female boxer, or were you focusing mainly on the men at that stage?
There was definitely probably 4 female fighters that I was like aspiring to be like obviously Caitlin Parker, Sky Nicholson, Kay Scott and Chrissy Harris. So those 4 girls were a part of the elite team, the elite program, and traveling around the world and competing. And yeah, I remember watching Caitlin Parker and Kay Scott actually fight in Perth when I was about 15 years old. And I was like, oh my God, I just want to be just like these girls. And then I ended up actually fighting Caitlin Parker 3 times. I was on the team with Kay Scott my first 2 years being on the national team. So yeah, it was a little bit surreal watching them as I was growing up and evolving. And then yeah, you kind of obviously hit that age where you go into the elite program and your role models become your rivals.
Yeah, I mean, how did they welcome you? Did they welcome you into the team? I mean, because sometimes in those situations, people see you as, you said, they're a rival for their position on the team. But did they welcome you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I think because you know, female boxing is not a big thing in Australia at all. So I think even all of us girls, whether you fight each other, you're from different gyms, different states, a lot of us kind of have a really good mentality. Like, obviously, when you're in the ring, you do what you have to do. But outside of the ring, there's no reason to be rude or super arrogant or anything like that. Like, we all understand you have a job to do. But outside of that, yeah, there's no need to, I guess, be nasty.
I mean, that's one of the things actually with boxing is you see even in the professional game, most of the former fighters are very friendly because there's a mutual respect that to climb through those ropes, it takes a special kind of person.
Yeah, 100%. I think we all know what it's like to work hard, and we all face the same challenges. We all go through, you know, the highs, the lows. We all just, like you said, have that mutual respect because, yeah, anyone that has the guts to go through the ropes and do what you have to do, and all the preparation as well, it's not an easy thing.
You mentioned, obviously, that your dad was your coach to start with. You've changed now and you're in the elite program. Do they choose a coach for you, or do you have a say in who it is? Because, I mean, obviously, if someone chooses it, you might not get on with them.
Yeah. No, so at 19, I kind of made the jump and I moved to Perth. And I started training with Justin Lacey out in Joondalup, which was a perfect fit for me. He had a bunch of elite boys there as well, so we're constantly pushing each other. So Justin is my home coach, and then so when we're in the elite program, our international coach, well, national coach, is Santiago. I don't even know how to say his name. Sorry, coach. Your last name is very complicated. But so Coach Santiago is our national coach, but he is amazing. I think he's definitely changed Australian boxing. He's got us going to more competitions, more experience, more exposure. And I think that's why we were so successful at this Worlds, especially for us girls. We don't get a lot in Australia. So to be able to travel and have more experience and just more exposure in general is a huge part.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've had 5 international competitions, is it, this year? And yeah, you've made the final in every one.
Yes, yeah, it's been an unreal year. Yeah, going to all these competitions, obviously we try to have pre-camps while we're away as well, just to spar with different countries, just get a bit more experience. And, yeah, I think it's definitely paid off. Making the final in every tournament has been unreal, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's that exposure, isn't it? Because there are different styles, there are different ways people do things, and it's just exposing yourself, not necessarily to overcome them, but also how to defend against it.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like, every country or every person is not going to box the same, so you need to be able to adapt. I think a really big thing that Santiago pushes is being a universal boxer. Like, you know, you need to know how to go forward, go backwards, be able to change your tactic. Like, if you lose that first round, what can we do now in the second and third to win that fight?
Yeah, and I think the other thing, of course, is in the amateurs, whereas the professionals now can watch videos. They never used to in the past, but now they can, and so they can analyse another fighter. But with you guys, you got 3 rounds in which to sort it all out.
Yes.
And to kind of manage to change your style.
Yeah, it's getting a lot easier for us to do video analysis because now everything's on YouTube. You know, people have phones, everyone's putting things on social media. So I guess, of course, going into competition, you don't know who you're going to draw. It's very, sporadic. You know, you just have no idea. But once you know who your opponent is, you can, yeah, do a bit of video analysis, you know, look up their fights on YouTube and that kind of thing, which can prepare you. But also, yeah, within the fight, you don't really have a lot of time to adjust. You need to be able to make those changes quick.
This year has been, you said it's been a great year. You've had 16 bouts and 13 wins and only 3 losses. And I noticed 2 of those losses have come to the lady you lost to in the World Championships final. That must be a little bit annoying.
A little bit. I was a bit gutted, especially like being at Worlds and we were on opposite ends of the draw. So it was really interesting to see us both like progress through each round. And then, when I drew her in the final, I was like, oh, this is my chance to get that loss back. But she is a great fighter. I mean, we both made it to the final for a reason. But yeah, I mean, I intend to hopefully meet with her again and yeah, definitely get an even score. So
did you learn a lot from that?
Yeah, for sure. Yep. Like I feel like we had a great game plan going in there, and I had a great preparation. Like, I can't say anything about that. But she's smart. She's Southpaw as well. I hate Southpaws. they are the bane of my existence. I actually fought three of them at Worlds, so it was a good, yeah. This year's been like full of great experiences, and also just putting my training to the test. So yeah, I mean, hopefully I can get those losses back, but yeah.
I mean, one of the big questions, of course, is it takes up a lot of time, a lot of training, a lot of traveling. I mean, how do you fund that? I see you've got a Commonwealth Games Emerging Athlete Scholarship, and I think Sport Australia Hall of Fame have also given you a scholarship. Do they help a great deal?
Yeah, so my scholarship from Sport Australia Hall of Fame, that was in 2023, and I received a Tier 2 scholarship, which helped heaps. At that time, I wasn't a fully funded athlete. Like, now being number one on the team, I am fully funded now, so when I go away, they pay for flights, accommodation, food, that kind of thing, which is a huge financial relief. But yeah, we don't essentially get paid to box. So hopefully next year, now that I have my world ranking and all this, my categorization will change, and hopefully I get a bit of money from that. But I definitely rely heavily on my sponsors, and I'm very grateful. I have probably, I'd say, four or five kind of sponsors that help me out financially.
And mention them.
Yeah, yeah. So S&C Heavy Haulage out in Queensland, I've actually known them since I was in diapers. They used to train at the gym years and years ago. So big shout out to them. Jones Welding Solutions, they've been with me since I was like 15. They helped me go to my first like interstate fight, which was amazing. I also have a bunch of other sponsors like Gobsmack Mouthguards. I have Everlast. I also have... Sorry, give me...
Sorry, not bad. I mean, Gobsmack is an essential one for the Mouthguards.
They are. They actually have been unreal. And it's just like it's the little things that count. Like, being a boxer, you're like heavily financially dependent on yourself. Like, when I first moved to Perth, I was working three jobs. I was, you know, paying rent, paying food, paying for a bunch of things that I just didn't have access to. But I'm also sponsored by EMR Marble and Granite, and they're out in Adelaide.
So you really are a national multi-state sponsor.
Yeah, I've been really lucky. Just these companies have, I guess, just wanted to help, which means the world to me. Like, you know, they don't have, like, a lot of these companies have nothing to do with boxing, but I think they see me as an athlete and as a person and someone that's trying to achieve their dreams. So yeah, I'm super, super grateful. I also, the most local one would probably have to be like Harvey River Estate. They're down south. Yeah. Also Glove Up, they sponsor me. Thank you, Claire. I'm trying to just think who else.
While you're trying to remember those, I mean, what do you do for yourself? I mean, like, career-wise, have you got time to be able to do anything for a career and establish something?
I think because I was so zoned in, especially, like, this year's been a really big year, and I haven't had to work, which has been amazing. Like, my sponsors have given me a lot of financial relief, which I appreciate, like, beyond. But I've just started like a few different courses in like fashion design, so something that I'm like interested in, I guess, after boxing. But yeah, I think just working three jobs for, you know, at least 3-4 years, I was kind of overworking, but to be able to just focus on the boxing side of things this year has been like unreal, and I think it showed really great results. And also getting my scholarship with the WA Institute of Sport, like, has helped immensely. Like, they do all my S&C, my nutrition, physio, doctor, and they're just a great support system in general.
And looking forward, is there anything left on the calendar for this year, or is it all now looking ahead to 2026?
Now we're just looking ahead to 2026. I made the decision, well, I guess me and my team kind of made the decision to have a good break, just because this year's just been like a very hectic year, but a very good year, and just ensuring that I don't burn out and I can just focus on qualifying for Comm Games in early January.
Well, congratulations on your achievements this year, and we're going to be continuing to watch you with great interest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
And that was Lakeisha Pergoletti, who hails from Bunbury in the southwest of Western Australia. But she's doing great things on the world stage in women's boxing. And John, when you think back to when we were talking to Claire Gabriel all those years ago, leading up to the London Olympics, women's boxing has really taken off as a sport. And it's great to see that they're getting much more support now from the boxing community and also the sporting bodies around the country.
And someone from regional Australia. I mean, Bunbury's not a small town anymore, but it's certainly in the global scheme of things, a small town. So, to come from somewhere like Bunbury, outside of one of the main centres, well done.
Yeah, and I mean, I when you look at it as well, Lakeisha this year, 5 international tournaments, 5 finals. That's a heck of an achievement.
Yes.
Especially in the sport of boxing where, you know, a decision can go against you sometimes when it's really unfair.
Well, what's the one thing we ask from our athletes is consistency of performance, and that is a consistent performance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think she's done fantastically well. I've obviously seen her boxing coming through over the years when I've either commentated locally or been the ring announcer for them. And I think she's a great name, and it'll be fantastic if she can get the Commonwealth Games gold, as she was talking about in the interview, and then who knows for the LA Olympics.
So how long have you been aware of her for, would you say?
Well, she started at 14, so she's sort of been boxing about 9 years. I would say I've been more aware of her probably the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
Was when I first kind of heard the name, got used to hearing the name, and everyone was saying what a talent she was. And it's just been great to see her come to fruition.
And good luck for the future, too.
Absolutely. As I said in the interview, we'll be keeping tabs on it.
Okay, my turn.
Yep.
Okay, this is a little thought bubble that I thought I'd just impromptuly expand on sitting here talking to you.
So we've gone off script, have we now?
Well, no. It's about umpiring. But I was watching the sport I play at the ground, watching a local top-level game, and I just got the feeling that the sport has got too fast to umpire. The umpires can't keep up with the pace of the sport. And is there some way to slow the game down so it makes it? I mean, you see a ball get crossed in front of the goals and there's sticks and all sorts of stuff flying there. As an umpire, you got no chance. The ball moves so quickly, not so much in the women's game, especially the men's game. It's just ping, 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 ping. And you've got very little opportunity to actually see what's going on. You've got people in front of you. And I just had the feeling that the game has actually got too fast for it to be umpired properly. Now, is this true? Who knows? But I started looking around at other sports. If you go to the NFL, they've got how many umpires, referees? There's 8 or 10 of them out on the field. They've got their little flags they throw down and all that. There is not one call that happens on an NFL field that does not get reviewed. Every call gets reviewed. So in some ways, you could not have the umpires there. Every time a play's made, they just review the play. Oh, no, this happened there. We're going to do this. But obviously, there's a lovely spectacle with a bloke throwing the little flag down and waving arms around.
Just looks like a duster to me.
But is that where we're heading? Is that going to be where we head with all sport?
Well, I'll flip that on the lid a little bit.
Okay.
Because something at Johor Cup, all the under-21s teams wanted to get used to referrals because they will be in place for the Junior Hockey World Cup. And so they had it, but there was no big screen inside the stadium. And you get good crowds in Malaysia. So they're all sitting there going, what is going on? We don't know what you're looking for. They couldn't see it on the big screen. We, in our live stream, couldn't see it. The only people that saw it was the national broadcaster in Malaysia, and they could hear what the referral was for. Now, I have a view with that if you're going to do video referrals, you have to. It's just common decency. If people are paying to come and watch or are getting off their backsides to go to the game live, you have to share that information with them. And I think if a stadium or a game is not going to give that to the spectators, then you shouldn't have video referral.
Now, in...
That's my view.
In association football in England, they go to the side of the ground. Is that right?
And they look do on now, a screen. Yeah, yeah.
Is that footage shown on
no,
any screen?
No, this is one of the things they had the A-League here. So the A-League actually defied the FIFA regulations where replays of any sort are not to be shown in the ground for fear of the trouble it could cause, the passions that would be arisen if they see that someone was offside or there's a problem with this. So that's why they don't. The A-League does it here because a lot of teams don't travel to away games, and that was their excuse as to why they do it. Perth Glory shows replays at their games. I'm not sure. I haven't been to a game over East for so long whether they do now or they don't. I know years ago when I was doing the commentary on the Glory games, they were showing replays inside the grounds on the East Coast.
Yeah, I just would have thought that, you know, the reason for not showing the videos is so you don't get a backlash from the fans. But if you have the vision and you allow one person to watch it and then make a decision based on that.
Yeah, the thing I don't like...
What are people... Well, why are you doing that, mate? What's going on?
Yeah, I think the thing I don't like with... I think VAR in football, video assisted referee, I don't think it's come out the way it's meant to. I think they've made mistakes. You've got like millimetres now that a player's toe is ahead of a defender's and they're going, that's offside. It's like, well, no, did he really gain an advantage by 2 centimetres? Come on. You know, it's, and I don't like the fact that the actual referee who's made the call then goes and watches the replay and they're supposed to reverse their own decision. Now, you know what some referees or umpires are like. They are quite, full of themselves as well, let's be honest. I did. Look, some are. I've played with some who I found incredibly difficult to deal with. But anyway, so you wonder, are they ever going to change their mind, you know?
And just continuing on umpires, because, and this is not umpire bashing, right? What's the purpose? An umpire, obviously, to control the game. And from just the sports side of things, integral, their job is to blah, blah. We all know that sort of stuff. But sport is now a product as well. It's an entertainment product. And in that entertainment product, umpires are the pantomime villain for that side of the game, that product side of things. And so, you know, the umpire makes a dodgy decision and the crowd goes, oh, boo, boo, he's behind you, boo, boo, you know, okay, great. That's part of the whole showbiz side of what sport is, right?
Yep.
But too often we see that carry on after the show's finished. they're acting as much as the players are acting, as much as the coaches act. It's all part of the show. So can we please just leave it there at the end of the show? Now, that doesn't mean you can't go back and have your television shows that look back at this incident and blah, blah. But don't refer to umpires by name. Just refer to them as the umpire. I don't think we need to identify umpires, because when you do, that's when that stuff starts. Oh, that umpire is a deal. And you keep the personality out of it and just make the umpires the villain. They're the, what's the Hamburglar? They're the Hamburglar of the sport. Even the Hamburglar dresses up in the black and white stripes, doesn't he? So no one knows who's in the Hamburglar suit.
True.
I don't think we need to know personality. Oh, there'll be a lot of people going, oh, that boy's got that personality. No. Because that's what gets everybody upset. Just leave it as a pantomime.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, the one thing I think as well that a lot of people that are overseeing the officials in sport, I think where they've made a mistake, in my opinion, is how they've told the umpires, referees, or whatever, the officials, not to interact with the players. Because my experience of having played sport at a reasonable level, talking to athletes who have played at the highest level, they have all said they prefer an official who knows the game, who will kind of go, "Lash, shut up, come on, we all know what you did there." And they prefer that because they know that this guy knows the sport, or this female knows the sport.
Yeah.
And they have far more respect for those. And yet when you hear that the people that are overseeing them are telling them not to do that, I think that is a huge mistake, because players actually respond to that far better than an umpire or an official that just goes, no, I'm not prepared to discuss it. Go away. They would much rather have a bit of banter.
And you know, it's also incumbent on the players and coaches and support staff to know the rules. I mean, I can't... how many times a year I would see a guy on a hockey field appealing for a free hit, and I look at this bloke, mate, that hasn't been a rule for 25 years. Obstruction's a great one, waving their stick in the air. That's actually a free hit against you and a card, mate, in the modern game, waving your stick in the air like that. So players have got to be better at knowing what the rules are as well. And that goes all the way to the top. There's guys playing top-level hockey that have got, hit my foot, that's about the only one I know.
Well, I'll tell you something that I do, and this is just a bit of an aside. Before every tournament, I will sit down with the person that's in charge of the umpires and ask them how the rules are going to be interpreted. The ones that are a bit questionable, maybe like the aerial pass. And, and it's interesting. So at the recent tournament, I went back because we'd had this conversation. I said, did I mishear you? Because the umpires aren't actually umpiring it the way you told me it was going to be. And he goes, no, they are the ones that are wrong. They are not doing it the way they've been told to do it. So this, again, is a big problem. So I think you even have those who are advising the officials, and that's just in hockey, that you have those who are advising the officials then find that the officials are not incorporating what they've been told. What I would like to see in local sport, and I think this would help a great deal, is rather than, and a lot of sports do this, they expect the clubs to send a representative to go to an umpire's meeting where they tell them how the rules are going to be interpreted that year, or the laws in some sports. Now, of course, what happens then, you've got Chinese whispers, because those people then go back to the club and try and share the information, and they may not have understood it properly. What rugby used to do here when I was playing in the state competition, rugby union sent their officials to the clubs, and at the club I was at, we were told, you must attend this. It's not optional, you must attend it. And so it was after training, we all went in, and the umpires would be, the referees would be there, and they would explain how the laws were going to be managed throughout that season. Now, I think that's a far better way than expecting the club to send a representative. I think it's incumbent on the sports to send their officials out to the clubs and explain it. And I think you would then see a lot of the dissent that some of the umpires suffer would actually become less.
Yeah. And, you know, there is also an onus on us as fans and the crowd and the, you know, the purchasers of these products that we leave it at where it is as well, at the end of the game. You walk away.
Yeah.
And you don't carry it with you. And, okay, so this incident happened, whatever. And that's all past now. Wait for the next game.
It's not. I still remember someone's dad, when he was bowling, gave me out twice.
Did he?
When I was a kid, yeah. He saw me as the danger player, and he just gave me out twice when I wasn't out.
I got chased around a field by a parent from the opposition once.
For umpire?
No, I was playing.
Oh, really?
His kid had done something, you know, whacked someone or done something stupid, and I yelled out, send him off, from like 40 yards away, and his old man was standing about 20 feet away from him. He came charging down, chasing me around the field.
Wow.
Anyway, on that bombshell.
Yeah, I think we should go.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is
done. See ya. We'll be back next week.